Good morning and welcome to the October 23rd edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, who sounds a little under the weather. Kevin, how you feeling?
I'm getting through.
Well, we're going to make it through this hour, and we've got some good stuff to go through. We're going to start by speaking with author Bill Taubman about his new book on former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, McNamara at War.
And then we'll speak with Ashley Bienvenu, owner of the Neat Method Park City, a company that can help you finally get organized. And we'll finish our show speaking with Alexis Brown of the Community Foundation and Garnet Barner of J.P. Morgan about Live PC, Give PC. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Robert McNamara was a towering figure as the Secretary of Defense during the Kennedy and Nixon administrations. One of the so-called whiz kids, McNamara was unquestionably a brilliant man. But he often receives much of the blame for the tragedy that was Vietnam. Brothers Philip and William Taubman have written a new biography of McNamara that probes deeply into the actions, motivations, and conflicts of McNamara's remarkable life. We're very lucky to be joined by Bill Taubman this morning. Good morning and thanks for joining us.
Glad to be there. Thanks for having me.
So in the introduction, you acknowledge that much has been written about McNamara. Given that, what motivated you and your brother to write the book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Well, it actually began with my brother in 2010. He was at Stanford, having taken an early buyout from the New York Times, where he was the reporter. And he was approached by a couple of Stanford professors who, on behalf of the widow of McNamara, the second wife, said she has some very interesting material which we think might be the basis for a new book. Well, my brother looked at the material and he agreed. Just to mention the kinds of things that were there were letters from McNamara's mother when he was in graduate school at Harvard Business School and in the war. There were letters from McNamara to his new bride in the early 40s. And there were letters from Jacqueline Kennedy to McNamara over the years, beginning in 1962 and continuing really until the 1990s. And all of these were new and hadn't been seen before. So my brother Phil decided he would do it. And he asked me if I would do it with him. And I said I would, even though my career has been a Soviet specialist. And I wrote biographies of Khrushchev and Gorbachev. I wrote a book about Stalin and the United States. But I couldn't resist this, in part because the new material was so fascinating, and also because, frankly, I ran out of Soviet leaders I wanted to write about. The only one left was Putin, and if I'd written about him, I probably would have ended up in a ditch.
And the new material is richly woven into the book and provides a lot of really interesting insights. Look, for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with McNamara, let's start with a little bit of his background and his career arc leading up to his participation in World War II.
Well, he was born in San Francisco, or at least near San Francisco, in 1916. And he went to high school there at the border between Oakland and Piedmont. Then he went to Harvard Business School. Then he entered the war. But to go back to his childhood, he was the smartest kid in the room, in every room he inhabited, even in first grade, and then the high school. And then I forgot Berkeley. He was an undergraduate at Berkeley. And he was one of only three students out of 3,000 who were admitted to Phi Beta Kappa in his junior year. And when he got to Harvard Business School, he was the top student there too. So he was a brilliant kid and the smartest kid any place he went. That's the main thing, and that helps us to explain how high he eventually rose in the government.
It also helps to explain, perhaps, some of the mistakes that were made, but let's sort of move into World War II, because I think as I was reading the book, it struck me that the tools and analytical approach that he brought to the military sort of reflected his future business acumen. Talk a little bit about how he looked at things like aircraft and materiel.
Well, he was, in a sense, a statistician. And what he did for the Army Air Corps in the war was to keep track and to figure out how many planes they had, how many sorties the planes had flown, how many targets the planes had destroyed, how many pilots the planes had lost. This kind of basic information, which you would assume the Air Force had, they didn't have. So he enabled this Air Force, or a couple of different Air Forces, the 6th, I think, in Europe and the 20th in Asia, he enabled them to operate much more efficiently and much more lethally. In fact, it got to the point where toward the end of the war, he was working on Guam under General Curtis LeMay, who was one of the toughest sons of guns the Air Force ever produced. And General Curtis LeMay ended up carrying out the firebombing of Tokyo, which killed 100,000 Japanese, which is about as many as the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. And McNamara helped LeMay by urging him to have the planes fly in lower than their ceiling, which was 20,000, go in at 4,000 so they could see the targets better and hit them better. This is one of the things that bothered McNamara's conscience, because he always felt thereafter that he had, in effect, been a war criminal.
Now, what tools did he acquire while at Harvard Business School that helped him in the war effort, besides being a statistician?
Well, I'm not expert enough on mathematics or statistics to tell you in detail, but as I understand it, what they did was they used the kinds of calculations that went into the way businesses checked on their past performance, and they used them to predict and prescribe future performance. That is, they turned what had been instinct, or flying by the seat of your pants, into a kind of science. And they had gotten this idea because General Motors had developed it during between the wars. But nobody had applied it as widely as Harvard was, and Harvard was teaching it to Harvard Business School students who were going out and applying it in businesses and also in the military, which is what McNamara did.
So McNamara takes these tools, and there are a lot of metrics, you know, X per X, you know, dollars per kill, all these kinds of things that are business concept, and he's taking them and applying them to the war. But then after the war, he goes to Ford. You get the sense, as I was reading the book, that Ford, when he got there, was a place that had also run largely by instinct. And McNamara's sort of brought his own numbers revolution to Ford. Is that right?
Yes. Henry Ford, the first who founded it, was in a way a genius for founding it, but he was also a mess. He didn't keep track of what they were doing, of how much it cost to build cars. And when McNamara and 9 other hotshot statisticians from the war decided to go to work at Ford Motor Company, at that point, Henry Ford II needed them desperately, because he himself, although he was Henry Ford II, he'd been a bust in college. He'd actually been guilty of plagiarism, and he didn't really know how to calculate the cost of a car. So these guys, with McNamara in the lead, figured it out and put Ford into the black, whereas it had been in the red.
Talk a little about his, there were a couple things during his Ford career that I found particularly interesting. Let's talk first about his management style. Talk about what it would take to go into a meeting with McNamara and come out successful.
Well, McNamara slowly developed a very distinctive management style. Early in his career, he was never a softie, but he had a warm spot in his heart for people who weren't as bright as he was. And he would reach out and help them, that is, lesser students at Harvard Business School. But at Ford, he developed a kind of super confidence in himself, and also a degree of aloofness and distance from the people he supervised. Although he was a great success in managing Ford Motor Company, working his way all the way up to become president, the first member of who was not a member of the Ford Motor Company family to become president. Even though he was brilliant, he was also distant and difficult, and people learned to worry about him. You know, he would call a meeting and ask for their opinion, and there'd be 5 opinions, and then he would give the 6th, which was his and which was correct, and make the others look foolish. So he was a superstar, but he was he was not a nice guy.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things you talk about is the fact that his aloofness is to some extent demonstrated by his choice not to live around the other Ford executives. I think you describe how he chooses to live in Ann Arbor, which is some miles away.
Yes, that's very interesting. He had loved living in Cambridge, Massachusetts when he was at the Harvard Business School. And in choosing Ann Arbor, he was choosing the closest thing to Cambridge in Michigan because it was the seat of the University of Michigan. And he didn't want to hang out with the other executives of Ford in Grosse Pointe or Bloomfield Hills. Instead, he goes to Ann Arbor and he hangs out with professors and politicians, and he commutes to work. And that was a sign of his wanting to distance himself from his colleagues.
You know, as we get into his tenure of as Secretary of Defense, I want to touch on a little bit about how his attitude towards socializing with his coworkers changed. You talk about how the social scene in the Kennedy administration, you know, the glowing scenes of Camelot, was pretty active. And yet, as I was reading, I was expecting McNamara not to want to be involved in that, but he was.
Well, his first instinct was to keep his distance from his other colleagues in the Kennedy administration. He even made it a kind of condition of agreeing with Kennedy's proposal that he become defense secretary, that Kennedy agree that he didn't have to socialize with his colleagues. So they decided, he and his wife, McNamara and his wife, decided to live at some distance. But then what happened? He got caught up in the social life after all, most particularly by becoming not only a colleague and a subordinate, but a dear friend of Kennedy himself. And we can talk about this later if you like. Also a dear friend of Jackie Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. But so he got caught in, and not just with the Kennedys, but with the whole Georgetown set in Washington. He became a player in that social scene. And Bobby Kennedy at his estate in Hickory Hill, Virginia, would have seminars and invite professors and other intellectuals for evenings of discussion, and McNamara was in the center of it. And when they played touch football, McNamara played touch football with them. And when they pushed each other into the pool, McNamara jumped in the pool.
So we sort of skipped over how he goes from Ford, but essentially one day the phone rings and he is asked to be Secretary of Defense. And after some minor sort of decision, he accepts and moves to Washington.
Yep.
How did he approach sort of the task of running the Pentagon? Was he bringing his Ford managerial style with him?
Yes, he did. And he was brilliant at reorganizing the Pentagon so that the civilian Secretary of Defense would be the man in charge. Because previously, under previous Secretaries of Defense, it was really the services who were in charge of their own budget and their own activities. And McNamara rearranged things so that the generals and the Joint Chiefs had less influence and he had more. I should add, however, that when it came to other aspects of being Secretary of Defense, he was much less experienced and much more naive. What I have in mind is foreign policy. You know, when should the military go and fight? Under what conditions? And his own experience in there was minimal. I'll give you one quick example. In September 1939, the war is just about to begin. The Germans are about to invade Poland. And McNamara and his buddies from Harvard Business School are touring Europe in a station wagon, which they bought and sent over and are riding around Europe. And they're in Berlin. And they even see and hear Hitler giving a speech. And McNamara confesses in his memoirs that he didn't realize that war was right around the corner. Now, compare that to somebody like John Kennedy, who had been all over Europe and had met British prime ministers and French presidents, and he'd even wrote a book about preparedness. I mean, McNamara was a naive compared to Kennedy. So in that sense, he had reason to feel insecure when he was given the responsibility of Secretary of Defense.
And what were his personal beliefs or views on the Vietnam War when Kennedy had asked him to be Secretary of Defense?
Well, I would bet that he had not thought much about the Vietnam War. Kennedy asked him at the end of 1960, and he was inaugurated, Kennedy was, and McNamara as SecDef in early 61. And the Vietnam War was not central to their thinking at that point. But once he became focused on the Vietnam War, he shared the view of his colleagues in the government and of many people in the United States, but far from all, that there was a communist threat and there was a domino theory that they all shared. And the idea was that if South Vietnam falls to the communists, all of Southeast Asia will fall. And if all of Southeast Asia falls, Japan may fall. And if Japan falls, watch out for India. And if India is threatened, then Greece and Turkey will be vulnerable. And if Greece and Turkey are vulnerable, the communists will end up all over Africa. And this was a described, this version, this is McNamara's version of the domino theory. This was described by Clark Clifford, who was a pal of the president's and later succeeded McNamara in 1968 as Secretary of Defense. But this theory, as McNamara saw it, was described by Clinton as the most extreme version of the domino theory he had ever encountered.
Okay, so it's 1961. You know, they're coming into power. At that point, the U.S. involvement in Vietnam is basically some advisors, right, as I understand it? How does that begin to evolve?
Well, it was Kennedy who wanted to limit the American involvement to advisors. And there were really just a few thousand of them, maybe 14, 15,000 by the time Kennedy was assassinated. And what happened was, and that Kennedy and McNamara, in October 1963, before the assassination of Kennedy, actually decided to start bringing advisors home, to announce that they were bringing home 1,000, and to agree between them that after Kennedy won the 64 election, which they assumed he would, then they would bring home the rest. Now, that's very important because Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, who replaces Kennedy, comes in, and he is also uncertain about what to do. And he says, we have this in the book, he says, Vietnam is a mess, and I don't know what the hell to do about it. So McNamara and Johnson at that point don't know what to do, really, and except maybe start bringing the troops home. But what Johnson does, faced with that decision, is decide to fight and try to win in Vietnam. And he gives a signal, which McNamara and the others pick up at their first meeting with Johnson, that's what Johnson wants to do. He wants to fight and win. And when that happens, what does McNamara do? He switches his allegiance to Johnson and Johnson's theory of what should happen next. And this is very important because this was typical McNamara. Throughout his life, McNamara glommed onto powerful, strong bosses. Henry Ford II, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, even earlier at Berkeley and at Harvard. So he gloms on to Johnson and Johnson's theory, and what does he do? In typical McNamara fashion, he makes the case brilliantly for fighting in Vietnam. And what does Johnson do, confronted with McNamara's brilliant case? He's convinced. So what you have here is a kind of vicious circle, or a sort of feedback loop, in which Johnson wants to fight, McNamara makes the case. Johnson is now more convinced, that means McNamara is more convinced. And on we go until we have hundreds of thousands of American combat troops. The big decision about American combat troops is in the spring and summer of 1965. That's when the decision is made to send ground combat troops, not just advisors. But here's the next step, if I can take this step. Just a few months after that, by the fall of 1965, McNamara has changed his mind, and he has decided the war is unwinnable. And we have another crucial fact from a new source. McNamara's chief Pentagon aide, a man named John McNaughton, keeps a secret diary. And in April 1966, less than a year after McNamara has pushed the decision to escalate, McNaughton records in his diary that McNamara says to him the following: "I so want to bring our boys home that I can't barely stand it." In other words, he is aching to bring the boys home in April 66, but he stays on in office until March 68.
Well, he doesn't just stay on in office. He is making, you point out in the book that he is making numerous public statements professing optimism. Share a little bit about what he is saying during this 65, 66, 67 period.
Well, first of all, in 65, when they're escalating, we have evidence that McNamara is the fiercest proponent of escalation. And then, as we just said, by that next April, he's decided the war is unwinnable. Now, what's he doing during that period of 66 to 68? He is in public praising the war. He continues to seem to be the most determined advocate of the war. He goes to Vietnam several times. While he's there, he sees evidence that the war is not being won. It's being lost. He even talks on planes coming back with his colleagues and says the war is not going well. But what does he do when he gets off the plane at Andrews Air Force Base? He says the war is going wonderfully well.
And the book is filled with documents where, you know, there's sophisticated articulation of what is and what isn't working, and mostly what isn't working. For example, the use of bombs, which was designed to create an atmosphere where perhaps the North would no longer support the Viet Cong, perhaps that would lead to a reason to negotiate. And that's happening, and McNamara is supporting it, but he's also recording why it's not working, isn't he?
That's right, and he knows that bombing isn't going to be enough to demoralize the Vietnamese, who are determined to fight on and on. At one point at a meeting, I guess it was in Washington, he's talking about a key element of the American strategy in Vietnam, which is pacification of villages, village pacification, where supposedly the American troops and the South Vietnamese troops are getting rid of the Viet Cong and pacifying these villages. And what does McNamara say? He says, there's not a single village in Vietnam that has really been pacified. He says, I've asked to go to these villages, and the generals won't let me because they know they're not pacified and I'll be in danger. So he knows that things are not going there, and yet he still presides over the war. He goes along with further escalation. He's against the too much bombing, but he's in favor of enough bombing to try to change the Vietnamese position. But he's also trying to promote negotiations. He's favoring halts in the bombing in the hope that North Vietnamese will respond by saying, okay, let's negotiate. But they don't. So he's really at a loss of what the hell to do.
Well, he's probably looking at it from a Harvard Business School point of view, saying, okay, let's bring them to the table to talk. And they're not playing. They never took any classes at HBS. So
exactly.
So meanwhile, I mean, we talk about the conflicts that McNamara feels, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later in his life. But I think we should stop for a minute and talk about Lyndon Johnson, who, on the one hand, is, you know, the tough Texan who doesn't want to be seen as the guy who folds. But on the other hand, is totally frustrated by his inability to focus on what he wanted to focus on. Johnson, too, had his doubts that I think are laid out in the book.
Well, he had these doubts that he said, I don't know how we're going to win. I don't know what we're doing. It's a mess. There's another thing about Johnson, which I think we were not the first to discover, but I think we were the first to highlight. It turns out that Johnson, who appears in public to be manic, you know, grabbing people by the collar and sort of pulling them up to his face and saying, we've got to do this, or we've got to do that. Johnson had periodic spells of depression beginning in the 1940s, when he would take to his bed and cover his head with his pillows and his blankets and refuse to come out until his wife, Lady Bird, begged him to come out and resume his duties. And people noticed this. George Reedy, his press secretary, worried about his being manic, depressive. And Richard Goodwin, Doris Kearns Goodwin's husband, who'd been a speechwriter for Kennedy and now for Johnson, was so worried about this that he consulted psychiatrists trying to figure out what was with Johnson. If this is what Johnson was like, it seemed to us, to Phil and me, that Johnson must have glommed onto McNamara as the ultra-efficient, supremely self-confident, super-energetic man who could solve any problem for him. And that's what he did. Because if you look closely, you see that Johnson seems to worship McNamara. He tells his wife, you know, every time McNamara leaves town, I can't sleep. When he goes to Vietnam, I worry that he won't come back. And Johnson pursues McNamara to the point where it would often happen that, let's say, on a Sunday, McNamara's at home grilling hot dogs for his family, and the phone rings, and it's Johnson saying, you gotta come over here for lunch. Put down your hamburgers. You know, he's seemingly can't function without McNamara. And I think that helps to explain why McNamara is so loyal for as long as he is to Johnson.
He understood that he was Johnson's teddy bear.
Yes, he was Johnson's pet. He was Johnson's favorite, as he had been Kennedy's favorite.
So what leads to the end? What leads McNamara to want to leave or be pushed?
Well, he becomes tormented by what he's doing. He has a growing sense of guilt, which he doesn't express fully until much later. Much later, when he's writing about this time, he says, you know, I've killed tens of thousands of people, American soldiers and Vietnamese, and I owe them an explanation, which he never really fully gives. But at any rate, he's tormented by what he's doing. Now, he doesn't resign, but at one point he runs into the president of the World Bank, who actually is thinking of retiring. And this guy says, well, Bob, how would you like to be president of the World Bank? And Bob would like that, but he doesn't want to ask for it. Meanwhile, Johnson has met the same president of the World Bank, and Johnson realizes, I can kill two birds with one stone. I get rid of McNamara. He's no longer Secretary of Defense. He becomes president of the World Bank, and under their rules, he cannot discuss the politics of his home country. So I get rid of McNamara, and I shut him up for as long as he's president of the World Bank.
And at this point, McNamara is starting to become a little bit more open about his doubts, and I take it that's why Johnson wanted him out.
Yes. Johnson sensed that McNamara was down on the war. McNamara had given a couple of speeches where he indicated that military means to national security were less important than economic and social action. On one occasion, a Senate committee calls in McNamara, as well as a bunch of American generals, to talk about the war. And McNamara goes on critical of the war, and what happens? Johnson calls him in afterwards and reams him and blasts him for perhaps the first and only time. And that's a sign that Johnson is now no longer happy with having McNamara.
Before we get to the end, I want to do a side question, which is about McNamara's relationship with Jackie Kennedy, which I certainly had never heard about before, and you go into in some detail in the book.
We go into a lot of detail, but not as much detail as some people want. And that is, we discover from reading her correspondence that she admired McNamara. She hoped that he would bring the war to an end. And we go so far as to say that her letters, some of them are love letters to McNamara. We don't unfortunately have McNamara's letters to her. But as I say, this is a very warm relationship, very affectionate. Well, there's some people who want to know how far it went. We don't say. We don't know. We say we don't know. And that's the truth. You know, was it a physical affair or just a regular affair or a platonic affair? We don't know. And we admit that.
Yeah, because you got the letters from McNamara's wife. So maybe there's something she didn't want to share.
He got the letters from McNamara's second wife. Yes, his widow. She also sold some of them at a Sotheby's auction. So she wasn't exactly keeping it all to herself either.
McNamara, later in life, remains tortured. What does he say, you know, 20 years later in his own books about justifying his role in Vietnam?
Well, in his own memoirs, he says, we were wrong, terribly wrong about Vietnam. He doesn't come out and apologize, but as I quoted him before, he says, I killed tens of thousands and I owe them an explanation. And he also talks in his memoirs and in transcripts we have of his conversations with people who were helping him write his memoirs. He talks about how he couldn't ever fully understand his own actions. Mm. You know, he says, when I was president of Ford and a hot issue came up, I would convene a group and we would debate what to do. Why didn't I do that about Vietnam? I don't know. And I'll give you two episodes which show you what he thinks of himself. At one, he's at a conference at Brown University and he's speaking about the war. And a Vietnam veteran in the audience stands up and points at him and says, you're a son of a bitch. And McNamara says, you're right. I am a son of a bitch. And the other episode is in 2002. McNamara is in Cuba at a Cuba conference about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Castro is there. He's still president of Cuba, I think. And he says, Mr. McNamara, you must come back in 10 years on the 50th anniversary of the Cuban crisis. We're going to have another conference. And McNamara says, I can't come back in 10 years because I will be in hell.
Last question. McNamara felt that there were some important lessons that should have been learned from the Vietnam experience. What are some of the key points, and to what extent do you believe U.S. foreign policy reflected that we actually learned those lessons?
Well, there are two kinds of lessons, and one of them he actually outlined, and that was the sort of lessons about policy. For example, we must not underestimate the strength of nationalism, as we did in Vietnam, when we focused on communism, whereas the Viet Cong was particularly interested in taking over Vietnam and uniting their country. Or, for example, we should not exaggerate what can be accomplished by military means in building other nations. Well, we later did exaggerate what could be accomplished by military means in Iraq and Afghanistan. So if McNamara had been listened to on those lessons, it's possible we might have avoided the disasters of Iraq and Afghanistan. But as I was saying, that's one kind of lesson. The other kind of lesson is lessons which flowed from his own personal flaws. And these were lessons like, for example, if the boss, your president, demands that you carry out actions that are against your conscience, don't just sit there, stand up, protest, and even resign, even with a howl of protest. And McNamara could not bring himself to do that. So that's a lesson that he doesn't draw as explicitly as the kinds of policy lessons that I just mentioned.
The book is McNamara at War. We've been speaking with one of the co-authors, Bill Taubman. Thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Well, I wish I could spend more time with you in Park City, Utah.
Well, please come out. We would love to have you visit. We'll be right back after this.
Home organization is a daunting challenge. Do you want to read this one?
Home organization is a daunting challenge for many of us. Just as speaking is a daunting challenge for Kevin this morning. Here in Park City, help can be on the way. We are joined in the studio by Ashley Bienvenu. She's the owner of Neat Method Park City. Good morning, Ashley. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you guys for having me.
And I'm sure you're resisting the temptation to straighten up our studio here, but let's start at the beginning, Ashley. What inspired you to get into this business and to bring the Neat Method to Park City?
That's a great question. So I have always been really passionate about working for things that make an impact in people's daily lives. So my past career was in corporate tech, and I spent the bulk of my time working in a company that had something that was called the toothbrush test. And that was that they wanted to make products and services that people would use twice daily. So truly impact people's daily lives. And when I knew my 20 years in corporate tech had come to an end and was thinking about what was next, I really realized that professional organizing did that same thing, that it's not just about the beautiful before and after photos that you see, although I do really like those, but it's truly about the impact that it has, giving people back time, giving people back the peace of mind when the chaos around them is now calm. And particularly here in Park City, I think we have such a unique community where people truly love to get out and enjoy nature, enjoy our community events, enjoy each other. And just having that one less thing to worry about at home is an opportunity really to give them more time to do that. So that's what inspired me, was really helping people every day make more time to do the things that they love.
So if our home is cluttered, we're in chaos?
In my mind, you are.
Yeah.
That's how my mind is wired. Everybody is impacted a little bit differently, you know, yeah, by their surroundings. But it could be something as easy as, wow, I know where my keys are every morning because there's a dedicated spot for them. And I put them in that dedicated spot every morning. So now I don't start my day stressed and rushed looking for them. It could be something that small to something as impactful as my entire home now has a system that works for the way that I live, so I can breathe a bit easier.
It's an interesting phrase you just used, which is systems.
Yes.
To what extent is the art of what you do integrated with the concept of systems?
I love that question, because if we have come into your home and just put things away in a beautiful fashion and left, we haven't done our job. The system is what sets our clients up for success and sustainability after we've left. So the system is what really creates the structure around the organization and allows our clients to maintain it when we're not in their homes anymore.
That really is a key, because you can straighten it up once, but if you haven't sort of come up with a methodology, a structure, as you say, it's just going to evolve back to where it was.
Absolutely. And that doesn't mean that we can't come back. We'll come back into clients' homes on, you know, a monthly, a bi-monthly basis, just to tidy up a little, right? But it is truly that system that allows people to continue to live that clutter-free life.
So if someone moves to Park City and they have, you know, a moving truck, are you there to take the boxes and then organize their home?
Absolutely. And we love moves. So we can show up there with the movers, get those boxes, unpack them for our clients, and get everything settled into the new place in the new system from day one. So they can truly have that peace of mind going into the new place. Nobody truly likes to unpack unless you're me or a member of my team. And so they can really go into that new space completely ready to go and ready to live and not have to live in a pile of boxes.
And so that is a classic sort of model of what kind of one kind of service you do. So we'll call that category one, the move.
The move.
Okay.
Dun, dun, dun.
Category two, I have been living in my house a while and it isn't working. Talk to us about a typical engagement along those lines.
Yes, absolutely. We love those too. We're not biased to the type of organization that we do. So in that case, we typically start out with just a brief phone call. We want to learn more from you. What's working well in your space? What are the pain points? We talk a little bit about our process as well. And then from there, we get into your space. We'll go for about an hour and really see the details, right? We'll get into those weeds, learn more about what you have, what you want, what you don't want. And then when we start the project, we actually start by helping you guys edit out your belongings. So that's to say, we help you determine what do you keep, what do you potentially donate or consign, what do you maybe relocate to somewhere else in the home, what do you maybe discard, and then we take it all out. So it gets worse before it gets better. But then we'll put it all back in that system like we've talked about, labeled so you know exactly where everything goes. And again, you can maintain it long after we've left.
So how many times have you had to repeat your visit to someone's house, let's say 6 months later?
Yeah, recidivist message.
That's a really great question. So we do have those clients actually who just know they want us to come back on a regular basis just because they know they kind of want somebody to reset the system.
Right.
Right? They have that self-awareness of they're going to do their best and they know the system will set them up for success, but they're realistic in just the way that they live. And so we're happy to do that. Like I said, if we come in monthly, if we come in every quarter, whatever the case will be, we'll reset that system. We'll tweak what maybe has changed in their lifestyle and isn't working anymore. Whatever they need, we're truly white glove and very bespoke in that way.
Do you have any rules of thumb as you bring in systems? Like, for example, if it's in a box that you didn't open from the move before, you probably ought to do something with it. Or if it's a piece of clothing you haven't worn in more than 3 years, maybe that's something you should go. Do you have rules like that that you bring into play?
Yeah, and we like to try to, we'll say, guide our clients when it comes to editing out their belongings, because ultimately this is their stuff.
Decision.
Yeah. It's not ours. It's their decision. And who are we to judge why someone is keeping something, right? We don't know what sentimentality something might have. So we certainly ask more of the probing questions, but really help our clients make that decision on their own. We have some that trust us implicitly, and they say, you know, if you think we should get rid of it, it's gone. But, you know, every client is a snowflake. Every project is very different. So it really just kind of depends on how the client's feeling.
Share with us, please, a recent project you had that really demonstrates the NEAT method.
Yeah, great question. We've actually, I know you said recent project. Can I actually talk about one that's coming up that I'm particularly excited about? I'm particularly excited about a move that we have coming up. It is a family that does not spend their full time here in Park City. They have a vacation home here. They have two. And they're in the process of moving from one to the other. And they're very excited about hosting Thanksgiving in the new home, which is currently under renovation, as lots of us are familiar with in the Park City area, renovation, new builds. They have three children at home, so they're very busy. They don't just have the time to pick up, come to Park City whenever they want and settle in. We're actually going in and doing their move the week of Thanksgiving to get them unpacked in the new house and completely settled in so they can host their whole family
and ready for the 11 together. And ready for that 11 o'clock kickoff on that Thursday.
Absolutely.
Morning.
Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and football.
Absolutely. Okay. How can people learn more about you and reach you and investigate your business?
Yeah, absolutely. So you guys can check out our Instagram at Park City Neat. You can also check out our website at neatmethod.com. There's a link directly there to get in touch and happy to talk more about whatever projects you all have top of mind.
Okay, just stay away from my house.
I don't know. We'll happily come. I'll give you that freebie consultation and check it out.
Exactly. Cool, man. We will be back in just a minute.
Halloween may be coming up on Friday, but the holiday that's coming just behind that is Live PC, Give PC. Here to talk about it, we have Alexis Brown of the Park City Community Foundation and
Abby Eddy.
Abby was a recent substitution in our preview. I promised you someone else, but we are fortunate instead to have Abby here. Morning, Abby. Thanks
Good
for being
morning.
Here.
Thanks for having me.
Morning,
Good
Alexis.
Morning.
Okay. There are signs around town that say Live PC, Give PC. How long has it been around, and how has it evolved over the years?
It's in its 15th year. We're in our 15th year of Live PC, Give PC, which if you're brand new to town or somehow have missed all of those signs, it's our community's annual day of giving. So raising money for all of the nonprofits providing services here in town. So this year, over 140 are participating and benefiting this community. And Live PC, Give PC is a one-stop place to support all of those nonprofits that you love.
And for those who aren't familiar, we're going to talk about how much fun it is, but let's do a little bit more of the sort of numbers. 140 organizations. Is that the biggest number we've had? Is that, how many of those are new, if you know?
As far as we can tell, it's as many as we've had. Last year, we had just over 130. So we've been so successful over these 15 years, raising $36 million for this community in previous years. So I feel like word's gotten out for nonprofits to get involved.
So let's backtrack a little bit. So let's say I'm a new nonprofit. What do I do? How do I get involved in Live PC? Because we see the signs, we make the donations, but what's working in the background?
The major benefit for Live Give and the Park City Community Foundation being involved is we do all that back end work. So we are hosting the platform at no cost to them from a fee perspective. So all of the dollars raised on Live PC, Give PC going directly to the nonprofit. We are doing it just as a benefit to the community. So easy way to get involved and raise money where all the money is coming to you with a fee from the platform, but lots of donors choose to cover that. So really lots of money flowing just straight to those nonprofits. We put together amazing toolkits to make sure that all of our nonprofit partners have what they need to get the word out, to share what their missions are, to be able to fundraise on the day. And we also have some amazing sponsors that have come to the table to provide some amazing prizes, so additional dollars that are coming their way to support their missions. And so we're kind of doing all that work on the back end.
And can people go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add, it really plays into that philanthropy is a pillar of park, being a Parkite and living in Park City and supporting our Summit County residents and all the people that live here. So many people really depend on the nonprofits, and all of us benefit from it. Whether you're out on a trail, you go visit the library, wherever you are doing in Park City, you're benefiting from our nonprofits. And so this is just a great way to support the nonprofit community, to give back, and to help your fellow Parkites.
And can people donate directly to Live PC, Give PC, or the Park City Community Foundation during Live PC, Give PC?
They can. We have our own initiatives that are up. So it is truly just this one-stop shop where you can go on to livepcgivepc.org and choose all of those nonprofits that matter to you, including the Community Foundation.
And including KPCW.
That's what's so much fun. During Live PC, Give PC day, during the course of the day, there are leaderboards where you're seeing different categories, and that's when you can sort of, you know, make your, we call it at my house, the video game day, where we pick the different not-for-profits that we want to donate to.
And I will just talk about the leaderboards for 1 second. Okay. So we have 8 leaderboards, 2 of which are new this year. So we have a small but mighty leaderboard, which is for nonprofits with a smaller operating budget to lift them up in the community. And then we have an Eastern Summit County leaderboard to lift up some of our partners in Eastern Summit County. And we have a one other new leaderboard for the sports and club teams at the schools, trying to include more young philanthropists in Live PC, Give PC. And then we have our Give Different Service Area leaderboards. And all of these are supported by our generous sponsors. So if I may thank our sponsors, please. Park City Mountain and Epic Promise as our presenting sponsor, Weed and Ranch as our peak sponsor, and then our apex sponsors of those leaderboards are Woodward, Talisker, Blue Sky, CVMA, Slopeside Village, Lisa and Greg Berglund, High West, and JP Morgan. And then we have other sponsors who make this all possible: Williams Metcalf Interiors, Kodiak Cakes, Marcella Club, Ski Butlers, Canyon Cutters, Gallery Mar, Grand Valley Bank, Summit Sotheby's, Colesport, and Elevated Builders. So it really does take a community to make this possible, and we're so grateful to those sponsors.
And what do these sponsors do? Some of them put up money for, are they giving donations to you? Are they sort of bearing the expense of some of these things? Tell us what some of, and then some of them offer some kind of matching things, don't they? Talk a little bit about both of those things.
Yeah, so all of our sponsors contribute cash to the operating of Live PC, Give PC to make the back end happen. They also support those leaderboards and additional prizes. So we have $47,000 in prizes that we are giving away at the Community Foundation to nonprofits that participate as additional incentive to participate on the day. And as matching gifts, there's lots of ways that there's extra incentives on November 7th to make your donation.
Most of the nonprofit organizations in town, on their pages, you'll see that nearly every dollar raised for all of these organizations are matched by additional sponsors and donors in this community who are really wanting to get everyone involved. So there are ways beyond even these sponsorships to partner with your favorite nonprofits to be a match donor.
So during the day when I click on, you know, and of course, like I said, we like to do it on the day of because it's just fun.
Yeah.
So during the day when we click on one of the not-for-profits, it will tell us whether there's a match.
Yep.
Is there a way to search for, like, where the matches are?
Yes, you can filter by Matt.
If I want to leverage my donating dollar.
And then the other piece that our sponsors support are the parties on the day. It's really fun. There's a lot going on throughout the day. And so we have our Giving Fest, which is sponsored by Weed and Ranch at the Park City Library from 4 to 6. And it's family friendly. We'll have music and tacos and donuts from Chomp and face painting and all sorts of fun games. And then our big party at High West Saloon from 8 p.m. to midnight. And this year, we also will have an additional party at the White House from 9 p.m. to midnight.
So wait, is the family-friendly party, is that new? I mean, I'm familiar with the Bacchanalia that goes on at High West. So you've added a second party. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years now, and it's been super popular. Just ways to get more families involved. As Abby mentioned, younger philanthropists. We want this to be a philanthropic community and really foster that. We already know how many people are generous in this community, so why not get all those younger folks involved?
So let's talk about some targets. Okay, we talked about how many participants you have this year. How much money was raised last year? I bet you've got that figure on top of your head.
Yep, but just over $5.1 million. And so this year, in honor of our 15th year, we're shooting for $5.15 million. So to honor the 15th year. And you'll notice when you're engaging in those leaderboards, Roger, you mentioned kind of gamifying. Really what we're focused on is the number of donors.
That was my next question.
Yep, right? And so we're hoping for 7,150 donors. Yeah, so there's 15s in everything, yeah. And it's plastered on our website, livepcgivepc.org. And so as you're engaging on the day, you'll be able to see where you fall. Make sure you get your whole family involved, because you'll be able to, your participation is your vote for your favorite nonprofits.
Now, we only have a little bit of time left, but can you crudely break down the categories? I mean, at the one end, we have like human services, we have education. What are the major categories of not-for-profits?
So we tend to, and as we know, nonprofits kind of cross some boundaries of their category, but we do sports and rec, we do health and kind of human services, kind of physical health. We have some culture leaderboards and a handful of others, but you'll be able to filter and sort through those on the day of as well.
And you can find all this on what website?
LiveBC, givepc.org.
Okay. Anything else you want to add before we go in? Last 15 seconds. Here we go.
Check out our social media. We have some really exciting giveaways coming up over the next 2 weeks.
Wow. All right. Thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this. And get ready for Live PC, Give PC next Friday.